They nod. I am the leader. They're all listening to me. These are Miss Peppy's new babies, I announced to them. What? Sita says. I repeat, these are the new babies of Miss Peppy, the fought dog. Little chap, Sita says, what are you talking about? I'm not just talking, I say proudly. I'm going to swap these bald-headed rubber dolls for Miss Peppy's babies and see what happens. Lulu smiles and reaches into a pocket where she has more fudge stashed away. Bayla starts giggling. Sita says, Shep, you know how Buggy is about that dog. You're going to get us all in big trouble. It's a great idea. I say, y'all leave it up to me. Just leave it all up to old little Shep. I wait until Buggy goes outside to collect rainwater like she always does for her houseplants. That dog's right behind her, almost peeing on Buggy's shoes. Buggy always says, it is so cute the way Miss Peppy powders her nose whenever I'm out in the yard. I plant Sitter at the sliding glass door to keep watch, and Lulu and Bayla stay in the hallway to tip me off if the enemy starts to come back inside. As it is, I got plenty of time. I sneak into Buggy's bedroom, snatch Miss Peppy's babies out from under the covers, and stuff Lulu's old dolls in their place. Then I run into the kitchen and cram those fake dog babies down in the trash can underneath the kitchen sink. Buggy's still outside, and I've pulled the old switcheroo off without a single solitary hitch. I walk over to the rest of the kids and give them the A-OK sign and say, check, like I'm a double agent. All right now, I instruct them, act normal. So we get out Sitter's Barbie and Ken dolls and switch their heads. It's great to see old Ken's head on a body with boobs. Sitter always gets a kick out of that. We all do. Buggy comes back inside with her poot dog, and we all say, oh, hi, Buggy, like we're children from Lourdes or something. She says, y'all are being so sweet. The baby Jesus is smiling at you right now. I can just feel it. We keep on playing with the dolls. I get out my troll doll, which is the only doll I have anything to do with on my own. The rest are sissy dolls. My daddy said my troll doll is a sissy doll, too, and he won't let me take it in the truck with him. But I still play with it when my daddy's not around. We all stand at each other trying to act like nothing's going on. I am so excited I can't keep my leg from bouncing up and down the way it does when something's up. Sita is rolling her eyes around like she's in a scary movie, and Bayla keeps licking his lips. He has the longest tongue you ever saw. He can touch his nose with it. Easy. Old Buggy's just watering her African violets, and Miss Peppy is trailing her around on those high-heeled toenails. I start humming, You Are My Sunshine, just so I won't start laughing. Finally, I see Miss Peppy get this thought in her head, and she heads in the direction of the bedroom. Sita jabs me in the side, and I whisper, Bombs over Tokyo. They're all looking at me, but I go on brushing my troll doll's hair like life is normal. Then the barking starts up. Well, it isn't really barking. More like a high yowling that you wouldn't expect from a dog the size of that runt. Buggy drops a watering can and runs straight back into the bedroom, her slippers flapping on her feet. We're all looking at each other like, all right, this is it. Buggy starts shrieking. Like she'd rehearsed all her life for something like this to happen. Like she'd practiced and practiced just to be ready to make those sounds. Jesus, Mary, and Joseph, she screams. Oh, Our Lady of Prompt Succor, come to our aid. We sit there laughing so hard without making any sound, the way we have to do at Mass when somebody farts. Then Sita says, come on. We'd better go in there and act surprised. So we all run down the hall, and there is Buggy in her room with that dog, both of them looking like they've gone right over the edge. The attic fan is pulling, and I can see the curtains getting sucked in, then letting go with the draft. I can hear cartoons still playing on the TV, and Miss Peppy is still making those high-pitched moans like someone's beating her. "Well, what's wrong?" I ask, all innocent. Buggy says, "Y'all don't even look. It's too terrible. Miss Peppy's babies have been kidnapped, and Buggy does not know how." Then she runs to the open window and looks out like she might actually catch a doll burglar trying to escape over the hydrangea bushes. My mouth hurts, and my face is starting to develop a twitch from trying not to laugh. Lulu starts to giggle, but Sitta pinches her, and she shuts up. Bay just stands there with his mouth open. Sitta comes over and stands in front of me like she thinks I might be in trouble.
"No big deal," I whisper. "I got things under control."
Buggy gathers Miss Peppy in her arms to try and comfort her, but that dog is in the middle of her own nervous breakdown, and she hauls off with her tiny poodle teeth and bites the inside of Buggy's hand hard enough to draw blood.
Well, we're just horrified. We're just fascinated. We are just about to fall out on the floor. I wonder, will Buggy finally up and get mad at this dog?
No way. She just stands there looking at that poodle with a retarded look of love. She says, "Precious little Miss Peppy, no one will ever know the pain you are suffering."
God damn, I think. I wish my daddy could see this. He'd know what to say. Then I think, oh, great, what if my grandmother gets rabies and croaks, and it's all my fault?
"Buggy," I say, "maybe you might want to pour some hydrogen peroxide over that bite." She looks at me like I'm a real doctor for thinking that up, and she goes in the bathroom to open the medicine cabinet, at the same time starting up a holy rosary out loud. She puts Miss Peppy down on the bathroom counter, and I swear, the dog keeps staring at me. That dog looks so lost standing there next to Buggy's false teeth container and 5-day deodorant pads that for a second I actually feel sorry for her. It's not her fault she lives in a crazy house. I say, "Buggy, maybe you better go to the doctor. Dog bites aren't good." She interrupts a glory be long enough to smile and say, "Thank you, blessed child, but you don't have to worry about Buggy. This is not really a bite, but more of a love nip from Miss Peppy, who is being tested by God this morning." It gets clear to me that my grandmother is sort of enjoying the whole situation. She herds us back into a room and makes us kneel down and recite the rest of the rosary with her. Buggy's on the prayer kneeler, holding Miss Peppy, who is shaking like Mama does in the mornings. It's hard to concentrate on the sorrowful mysteries with those bald-headed dolls still staring up into space from the bed. We just cannot take our eyes off them. Lulu starts to blurt out something, but I put my hand over her mouth, and Sitta says, "Lulu, be quiet. We are praying." Then Lulu bites my hand, and we both start giggling, but I try to make it sound like I'm coughing instead. I act like I'm thinking about all of Jesus' suffering so I won't totally lose it. But then Miss Peppy jumps out of Buggy's arms and starts clicking her toenails in the direction of the kitchen. We rip through 9 more Hail Marys before Miss Peppy lets out a series of yips that sound like Nazis are pulling out of teeth. Buggy runs into the kitchen with us close on her heels, and I can't believe the sight in front of my eyes. The dog is standing there on the linoleum floor with her babies dangling out of her mouth. They are covered with coffee grounds, and a banana peel is hanging off one of their arms. That dog has actually nosed open the kitchen cabinet, knocked over the trash can, and fished those dolls out. The poodle starts turning in circles, jerking those dolls up and down so hard it looks like her own head is gonna snap right off and roll across the room. The dog has lost her mind. She's found her babies and lost her mind.
We've never in our lives seen an animal act like this. We've seen Mama act like this, but never a dog. Buggy is red-faced and sobbing, and she turns on us. Which one of you pagan children did this? She screams. Which one? Who? Who did it? Who has done this cruel thing to Miss Peppy and the baby Jesus? We just stand there looking at her. I love the way her eyes bug out and her veins pop when she gets real mad. This is more fun than I thought it would be. It's worth getting in trouble for. Bayla's holding on to Sitta and Lulu's chewing on her hair, as usual. I figure I better be the one to say something. Buggy, I say, it is a terrible, terrible thing that has happened here, and we are real sorry, but we don't know one thing about it. She says you should all be shot with a gun. But Buggy will not sin over the likes of you. The baby Jesus will punish you enough. Y'all will burn in hell along with your Baptist father. Then she locks us in the grandchildren's room for the whole rest of the day so we can pray for forgiveness. We play with all our toys, and I make fun of Buggy's face and do a series of Miss Peppy imitations. I make us all lose our breath. We laugh so hard. When Mama finally gets back, it's already dark. Buggy lets us out, and we fly down the hall to greet Mama, climbing all over her. She smells like air conditioning and department stores, and she has all kinds of gifts for us. An Etch-a-Sketch for me, 2 tortoiseshell headbands for Sitta, a wind-up elephant for Bay, and a pogo stick for Lulu. All from Lafayette.
We're starving to death, Mama,
Sitta announces.
Yeah, Lulu says. Buggy hasn't fed us since 12 o'clock noon.
All she did was feed that dog, I say. Mama turns to Buggy and says, Mother, why haven't they been fed? Buggy reaches down and scoops up Miss Peppy in her arms. She says, Because your oldest son bit Buggy on the hand, and she has a bad fever. Mama says, Well, that is the first time I've ever known Little Shep to bite anybody. Maybe it was just because he was hungry. Buggy says, It is not funny, Vivianne Abbott Walker. It is not one bit funny. I'm just glad it's you and not me who is responsible for the souls of these children. Don't worry, Mama says. I'll take care of Little Shep when I get him home. I get a little nervous when she says that because Mama sure does have her ways. She kisses Buggy on the cheek and says, Thank you for keeping the little monsters, Mother. Here, I brought you some perfume samples from Godshark's. And she hands her a bunch of little vials that Buggy already has drawfuls of. When we get home, Mama makes us pancakes for supper, and she lets me help flip. She doesn't eat anything herself, just fixes a drink and bottles her new clothes for us. She says to me, Well, my little cannibal, how do I look? Doesn't this dress look good enough to eat? Is your mama a living doll or what? Later, she comes into my bedroom to tuck me in. I say, Mama, I want to tell you something. I didn't bite Buggy, really. That dog did. She holds a cigarette down by the side of my bed. I lean my head over, and I can see its red tip burning in the dark. I know, little Shep, she says, and she outlines my lips with her fingers. But you have simply got to stop behaving when I leave y'all with Buggy. Decent babysitters are hard to come by. You're my big man, you understand? Yes, ma'am, I say. You don't know anything, you old witch, I think. When she leaves the room, I just lay there and play back the whole day. Just thinking about all I have accomplished makes me feel great, like I can do anything in the world I want, and no one can stop me. I am a born leader.
Beatitudes, Sitta Lee, 1963. At Our Lady of Divine Compassion parochial school, I keep running into trouble because the nuns say Daddy is rich, which he most certainly is not. For instance, Sister Osberga never lets me be in charge of the record player.
She says, your father is so rich that you'll probably break our record player on purpose just to show he can afford to buy a brand new one.
Blessed are the poor, said Lee Walker, and you are not one of them.
The Divine Compassion nuns are all bent out of shape because my Baptist grandfather, Pap, once owned some land that Bishop Seminole tried to beg off him for a new church. Daddy says they sicked every fast-talking priest and Monsignor they could find on Pap. When Pap finally decided it was too much land to give away to a church he didn't even like, the bishop told him he had blown his one shot at heaven, and that went for his whole family, too. He told Pap this over a big country breakfast my grandmother had prepared for them out on her porch. Daddy loves telling the story of how his mother snatched one of her angel biscuits right out of that bishop's hand and said, you'd better get yourself up from the devil's table and get off of my porch. When Daddy was little, he used to sing in the choir at Calvary Baptist, where his mama organized church suppers. Now he claims he has his own church, the Church of Sunday Drives and TV Football. He says the old Podna, which is what he calls God, lives in the cotton fields as much as he does over at Divine Compassion. Before he could marry Mama, they made Daddy sign an official document promising to raise all of us in the Catholic faith. He also agreed to go to Catholic instruction every Thursday night for 2 whole years. But when push came to shove, Daddy refused to join the Catholic Church. He said, y'all are like sheep to the slaughter when it comes to the penguins, which is what he calls the brides of Christ. Y'all can drag me to Mass on Christmas, he says, but other than that, don't swing that damn incense in the direction of my sinuses. Now, I didn't even know about this before we started at Divine Compassion, but at school, I'm always singled out because I'm the child of a mixed marriage. That means I'm likely to make the baby Jesus cry a lot more than a kid with 2 Catholic parents. From the minute I started first grade with my hair down to my waist and my brand new baby blue nifty folder and fat crayons, I have been worrying myself sick about making the baby Jesus cry. The nuns have us divided into 4 groups. Number 1, fast and slow readers. I am fast. Number 2, talker and non-talkers. I am a talker. Number 3, Catholic marriage and mixed marriage kids. Y'all already know what I am. And worst of all, number 4, children from broken homes, the kids whose parents are divorced. Broken homes is the most shameful group to be in, but at the same time, it gives you more leeway. I'm here to tell you that kids from broken homes can get away with a lot more than the rest of us can, which is not fair if you ask me. You pray for children from broken homes right along with the public school kids and pagan babies. You can buy a pagan baby for $8, and that means you get to name it yourself. We have mayonnaise jars with pictures of pagan babies taped on them, and the lids have slits to put money in. If the $8 comes from the whole class, then we all vote on the name. But if someone just walks in and forks over $8 on their own, then they can name the pagan baby whatever they want. One time, little Shep took some money Daddy gave him and named a baby Orlon, which the nuns didn't think was funny at all. But it was his money, so what could they do? He went around for weeks telling people there was a kid somewhere in a pagan country named Orlon, all because of him. That just cracked him up. Little Shep can sin his butt off and not blink an eye. Sometimes I wish Little Shep was in my class so he could take up for me. Like when Sister Osberga announced to the whole class that our mama lets us go to C-rated movies, which is definitely not true. Every Wednesday, when the diocesan newsletter comes out, Mama cuts out the Legion of Decency's list of movies and tapes it to the inside door of the canned goods cabinet. We have to consult it before making any movie plans whatsoever. There are A1, A2, A3, A4, B, and C movies. Walt Disney movies are A1. If somebody cusses in a movie, it is an A2.
If somebody kisses too long on the lips, it is an A3. And if unmarried people kiss at all on the lips, it is an A4. In the B movies, people take the Lord's name in vain while they take off their blouses. And in C movies, like Cleopatra, they just send their lives away in front of anyone who gets to watch. We only get to see A1 movies, unless there is something Mama and the Yayas just have to go see and they can't find a babysitter. But secretly, I am dying to go to a C movie just once in my life. I love those photos of Liz Taylor with her bosoms and eye makeup, the royal gowns, and all her dates with Richard Burton, which Buggy says is just awful. Buggy says, "That poor, sweet Debbie Reynolds, just look how she is forced to suffer, all because Liz stole Eddie away from her in front of the whole world. That Liz didn't even love him. She just wanted to prove that her violet eyes could break up a happy marriage, even if it was a mixed one. And now the sinner has dropped that poor Jewish boy to carry on with Richard Burton. It just makes me sick to my stomach." Impure thoughts, impure acts. Everywhere I turn, I stump my toe on impurity. It seems like every thought that comes into my head is impure. I worry that I'm sinning all the time just because of the way my mind works. Thoughts have a lot of power. Just thinking about committing a sin is the same thing as actually doing it. Sister Osberga talks about this in class all the time. She says, if a man plans to kill somebody, but on the way over there he gets hit by a car and dies, then he will die with the sin of murder on his soul, because he has already killed a man in his mind. In his mind. I could never get my mind pure. I keep thinking of impure things every minute of the day. They are like rats crawling across the floor of my brain. So I've started going to confession every day. There is nothing in the world like that light, pure feeling the second you step out of the confessional. It's such a relief to know that if you croak over right then and there, you'll go straight to heaven. But the pure feeling wears off quicker and quicker every time. Sometimes I have to turn right around and go straight back into the confessional and confess the sins I committed in my mind in just 2 minutes. The priest says, "These are little things. Stop thinking about them so much. Do not come back here for a whole week. You should go home and ask your parents to take you to a psychologist." Well, that gives me diarrhea for days. I need to go to confession. Sometimes I just pray to become a leper and get it over with. I still want to see those nasty movies, though. But Mama says, "You will never so much as set foot in a C movie. Do not ask me again." We'll be driving in the car, and she'll blot some of her blood-red lipstick with the Kleenex. "Why, Mama," I pester her, "why can't I go to a C movie? Listen to me," she'll say. "Sex is for marriage. Marriage is sacred. It is a sacrament." "I know, Mama, but why can't I go to see Butterfield 8? But she just lights a cigarette and says, "Oh, will you shut up before you drive me to the insane asylum?" It's a real double whammy, being from a mixed marriage and not being poor and holy. It means I have to do much more self-mortification than your regular kid. Sister Osberga says, "Remember, any pain, discomfort, inconvenience, humiliation that comes your way, offer it up. The more you can offer up, the more indulgences you can get, the less time your soul will have to suffer in purgatory." I try to commit little acts of self-mortification every day. First of all, lying in bed, I pinch my stomach until it hurts and bruises blue. Then later, when I have a bad thought, I lift up my blouse and see that bruise, and I don't feel so guilty. Second, when I have to go to the bathroom, I hold it for as long as I can. Sometimes this gets me into tight spots, but the way of the penitent is not always easy. If I'm feeling particularly bad about something I've done that day, I wait until Lulu is asleep, and then I lie down on the bare floor and try to sleep with no covers, just like Saint Teresa the Little Flower. I write down all of these things in my diary and try to figure out at the end of each week how many days I've burned off my time in purgatory. You gotta rack and stack those indulgences. I learned how to read way before first grade, thanks to Mama and Aunt Jessie. Children's Lives of the Saints was my first book. Buggy gave it to me. St. Martin de Porres, the patron saint of the poor, is the one I really go to for intercession. St. Martin was a barber during the day, but at night he had all kinds of visions. He was the son of a knight and a Negro woman from Peru. And even when all the people started calling him the Father of Charity, he just called himself Mulatto Dog. Every single time I talk about St. Martin, little Shep starts barking and yelling, "I'm a mulatto dog, woof, woof." My all-time favorite, though, is St. Cecilia. She was from a rich family, and they made her marry this good-looking pagan. But St. Cecilia had already promised God she would stay a virgin forever, and so she refused to do it with her husband and actually managed to convert him. So they sentenced her to be suffocated in her bathroom. But she just kept on miraculously breathing. Then a soldier went and tried to chop her head off 3 times, and she would not die. She lay there half dead for 3 solid days. St. Cecilia is one of the things my friend Marie Williams and I have in common. We are fascinated by her. Marie and I open the saint's book to St. Cecilia's picture and just stare at it for hours. We try to figure out whether St. Cecilia's head was actually still attached to her body while she was lying in that bathroom half dead, or whether it had sort of rolled off to the side. Now, as I have said, Daddy is not rich. Oh, sure, we have enough money for Mama to get her hair done once a week, but not at Mr. Julian's, where they serve sherry and where Melaine Chauvin's mother goes. Mama goes to Janine at the House of Beauty because she claims Mr. Julian will not use her brand of hairspray. Mama says Julian is full of shit, charging as much as he does, just because he uses hairspray in a pump bottle from France. Janine is a black-haired woman who's a big-time bowler at Bowl Arena out on Highway 17. Mama's appointment is every Friday before her big grocery shop at the Piggly Wiggly. Mama is convinced that she doesn't have enough hair. Janine sold her this little hair piece that fits on the back of her head, and every Friday she washes and sets that hair piece along with Mama's real hair. Then Janine sticks it on the back of Mama's head, where it stays until she takes it off at night. She puts it in the night table drawer while she sleeps, and it looks like a little strawberry blonde rat. We are not supposed to talk about it. On Fridays, Mama brings the hairpiece to the beauty shop with her in a plastic bag, and I bring my spend-the-night things to school so I can ride the bus home with Marie Williams and sleep at her house where everything is all poor and holy. See, even though the Williams aren't dirt poor, at least they use powdered milk. Marie's father is a garage mechanic, and her mother is a housewife named Antoinette, and they don't have a maid or anything. Their house is absolutely cram-packed with kids and canned food and crucifixes. Their yard has 1 tree in it and a barbed wire fence and almost no grass because their mongrel dog is such a rooter. They are real Catholics with a big family, not like Mama and Daddy who stopped after just 4, 5 if you count my twin that died. They have 7 children in a 2-bedroom house. All 6 of the girls sleep in 3 sets of bunk beds in 1 room, and their brother sleeps on the fold-out couch in the living room. He waits until everyone's finished watching TV to unfold his bed. Since it is so crowded at their house, Marie sleeps in a sleeping bag on the floor when I spend the night, and I sleep in her top bunk above her sister Bernadette. I am so jealous of the fact that they all got named after saints. Do you think Mama gave a damn about saints' names when it came to us? No. I ask you, who ever heard of a Saint Cydalee? Who ever heard of a Saint Lulu? When I bug Mama about it, she just says, most of those saints' names are just too Italian-sounding for my personal taste. On Friday evenings, the Williams sit around a crowded dinette table in their tiny kitchen. The older girls help their mother prepare the tuna loaf or other poor people's food. Afterwards, I always go home and beg Mama to use powdered milk. She sometimes buys some to indulge me, but there's no way tuna loaf will ever pollute her kitchen. My parents are steak and baked potatoes people, and that smell of Lee and pear and steak sauce sprinkled on near raw meat drifts out from under the broiler at least 5 nights a week. Daddy raises his own cattle, so after dinner we're all expected to say, "Mmm, good meat, Daddy," like it's his own flesh we've just eaten instead of a dead cow's. On Fridays, when we can't eat meat, Mama cooks red snapper or fried shrimp. But her idea of a meal does not include tuna loaf. All I want is the Williams's macaroni and day-old bread. And the way Marie's mother makes things last, and her father wearing those green overalls, and the brother Jude with his old Popular Mechanics magazines. Oh, their bathroom is so heavenly, it smells like cedar. And they have these huge bottles of the cheapest shampoo and cream rinse like I always see at Crest. They use sweetheart soap, and they have those kind of towels that come free inside of jumbo boxes of laundry detergent. Even with all the people who use that bathroom, it's always clean. Mrs. Williams has a handwritten sign by the sink that says, "Did you clean up after yourself?" Sometimes I lock myself in there just to stare at all the poor people's stuff in their cabinets. Gigantic, industrial-sized bottles of aspirin. And they never use toothpaste, only baking soda in huge boxes. There is a picture of the Holy Family next to the sink mirror with Jesus, Mary, and Joseph standing behind a gate. I do a few genuflections there in the bathroom and murmur a quick prayer before one of the little girls starts knocking on the door, needing to get in and pee. I feel lighter and purer every time I step out of the Williams bathroom. It's almost as good as going to confession. I swear, if the Pope himself came to Thornton on a surprise visit, he'd drive straight over to the Williams's house and not be disappointed. On Saturday mornings when it's cold outside, Mrs. Williams makes a huge pot of oatmeal. Each of us gets up and ladles some into a cup. Then we crawl back into bed to eat it because the house hasn't warmed up yet. They don't have heat in the bedrooms, so it's much warmer under the covers. But your toes freeze off from walking barefoot to the kitchen and back. If Mama ever found out I was this cold, she would stop me right away from ever visiting them again. But as it is, I knock off days in purgatory right and left just by spending the night in that wood frame house. Marie and I lie in the top bunk in the morning and pretend to be missionaries, and we sing Dominique like the singing nun. We discuss how we'll be missionary nurses instead of nuns, because in Africa what they really need is medical help. Plus, we don't want face warts with stiff hair sticking out like Sister Osberga. At the Williams house, every single bit of food is rationed. If you take more than your share, it's against the rules. I know that because it was one of the first things Marie explained to me when I started spending the night over there. I love it. It feels like we're all pulling through a war together by not being pigs. But one Friday night at dinner, when they are passing around the plate of day-old sliced white bread, I swear I get possessed by Lucifer. I know that there's only enough bread for each person to have one slice, but that does not stop me from reaching out and grabbing two pieces so fast that nobody notices. I hold the pieces together so they look like only one. I smear one of them with margarine and put the other one in my lap. The blue plastic bread plate gets handed all the way around the table, and when it stops in front of Mrs. Williams, there is not one single solitary slice left for her. I stare down into my spaghetti and tomato sauce as Mrs. Williams asks, "Who helped themselves to 2 pieces of bread?" I start sweating. I begin balling that second piece of bread up in my palm so it fits there like a sticky little glob of Play-Doh. Each of the Williams children looks up at their mother with these totally innocent eyes. Mrs. Williams calls the roll to find out who the greedy one is. "Marie? Bernadette? Kathy? Teresa? Monica? Jude?" She leaves out Mr. Williams and the baby girl, who is still in a high chair. I'm so thrilled with what I've put into motion that I can hardly sit still. I don't know how I can ever confess this. It feels great, like something I was born to do. I play with my food and steal little glances at the Holy Family's drama. Finally, Mrs. Williams settles on Jude. "Leave the table, Jude," she says.
"But, Mama," he protests, "I only took 1 piece, I promise."
"Please leave the table until you can learn not to take more than your share," she tells him.
"It's not fair,"
he starts to say, but Mr. Williams interrupts.
"You heard what your mother said, son."
And Jude gets up from the table without saying another word. I have never seen a boy take something like that. All humble, like Jesus, when he was unjustly accused, and all because of me. After dinner, I say to Mrs. Williams, "Thank you for the lovely meal. May I please be excused now?" Then I go into the bathroom and flush that balled-up bread down the toilet. Later that evening, I teach Marie and Bernadette the dance number to Personality that I've been learning in dance class. I tell them, "I don't see how y'all can stand living here. There's not any room to tap dance at all." The next day, Mama comes to pick me up on her way home from one of the Yaya Bure games. Her hair is particularly poofy, with the hairpiece done in this cascade of waves. She has that anything-can-happen Saturday afternoon look, and her arm is propped on the partially rolled-down window with a cigarette dangling between her fingers. Mrs. Williams comes out of the house, wiping her hands on a dish towel, and walks to the end of the driveway to be polite. Marie and I hug goodbye, and I climb in beside Mama, with her plastic tumbler of vodka and grapefruit juice sitting on the seat between us. Mrs. Williams says, "Oh, Mrs. Walker, your hair always looks so pretty." Mama smiles generously.
"Thank you, darling," she purrs. "You don't know what I go through to get it like this. I only have 3 hairs on my entire head, you know. The whole thing is done with mirrors."
Mama loves to put herself down when she's feeling all superior to someone. It's how you can tell something is coming. She lifts up her sunglasses and then French inhales while she stares at Mrs. Williams' hair. This is the first time I notice how oily and stringy it is. It has no luster to it whatsoever. It looks like the kind of hair that if you sniffed it, it would just smell too human to bear. Mama says, "You know, Antoinette, you really ought to get yourself on over to the House of Beauty. Talk to Janine. She's my girl. Tell her I sent you. Would do you a world of good. You really shouldn't let yourself go like that." I cannot believe my ears. Mama telling a poor, holy woman that her hair is ugly. Mrs. Williams rubs her hands on the dish towel like they've got something on them. She takes a tiny step back from the car and stares down at the grass growing through the cracks in the driveway. Then she clears her throat and says, "I wish I could, but we just can't afford it."
"Don't be ridiculous, Antoinette," Mama exclaims. "You can't afford not to."
Then Mama puts the car into reverse and slowly backs out into the street. Idling the motor for a minute, she instructs me, "Tell Mrs. Williams what a delightful time you had, Sitta." I cannot bear to look at Mrs. Williams with her hands hanging at her sides. Marie is standing beside her, and for a second I have this clear vision that when Marie grows up, she will look exactly like her mother. I say, "Thank you, Mrs. Williams. I could not have had a more enjoyable time." But what I'm really thinking is, I'll have to do penance for my mother's sins, along with my own, for the rest of my life. Mama points the car toward home, and I turn on the car radio because I do not want to talk to her. She takes a sip of her drink and says, "Did y'all have fun? What'd y'all do?" I tell her we pretended to be Connie Stevens. I don't mention a word about our missionary plans. Mama reaches into her purse and hands me a piece of gum. I put it on the seat beside me. She keeps driving along for a minute or two before she says, "Listen to me, Siddeley, and listen good. There is no excuse to let your looks go, no matter how poor you are. Cleanliness might be next to godliness, but honey, let me tell you, ugliness will get you nowhere." "Yes, ma'am," I say, and I stare out the windshield of the T-Bird. Well, after that, I am just too ashamed to set foot in the Williams's house. Marie asked me to spend the night, and I just have to tell her, no thank you, even though it breaks my heart in two. A couple of months go by, and I'm at Bordelon's drugstore, with Mama waiting out in the car for me while I run in to pick up some of her nerve medicine. And who do I see over by the vaporizers but Mrs. Antoinette Williams? At first, I don't even recognize her because she has lost weight and she has this new haircut. I think about running and hiding, but she spots me and walks right over. "Siddeley," she says, "how are you? We sure have missed you over at our house." "You have?" I think. I say, "You look so different, Mrs. Williams. I mean, you just look so pretty." She says, "Well, I have your mother to thank for that, Siddeley. She is the one who inspired me to start taking care of myself. Your mother is a good lady. Don't you ever let anyone tell you different." I can't think of a thing to say, except thank you. She says, "Don't be a stranger to our house now. You're welcome anytime you want." Then she walks away down the aisle, and I pick up Mama's medicine. When the druggist rings up the bill, I sign for it on Daddy's charge account. Then I walk out of the store. I feel light and good. I feel like I've just come out of confession, even though I've only been in a drugstore, not a Catholic church. Even though Mrs. Williams is a regular person, not a priest or a nun or a saint. The Elf and the Fairy, Siddeley, 1963. Our Lady of Divine Compassion parochial school is surrounded by sycamore trees. In the fall, those big leaves turn yellow, and the scorching days of summer are almost over, and you can start breathing again. I walk every school day underneath those trees to the music building, which is between Divine Compassion and Holy Names Academy, where the high school girls walk and talk in their blue and white straight skirts and starched blouses. I can hear them at choir practice while I'm walking along with my music folder under my arm. I love the high school girls, especially the ones with bubble hairdos. But mainly, I love getting out of regular classes to take piano. It's the calmest part of my day. I get so tired of everyone, from my classmates to my brothers and sister to my mother, making so much noise all the time. I take my quiet wherever I can find it. On lesson days, I knock on Sister Philomena's frosted glass door. When she says, "Do come in," I open the door and say, "Good afternoon, sister." She is a big nun with a wide face who quotes the Bible a lot. She always seems glad to see me. I'm working on my recital piece, The Elf and the Fairy, which is considered quite a difficult composition for fourth grade. At first, Sister Philomena asked me, "Siddeley, are you certain that you want to choose such an advanced piece for your recital?" "Yes, sister," I assure her. "I love that piece. I can handle it, I promise you." This is my big chance to take something hard and do it right. The first time Sister Philomena plays The Elf and the Fairy for me, I close my eyes and go somewhere else, to a place in another state that doesn't have all the hot white light of Louisiana. There are waterfalls there, and the air is so sweet and easy to breathe. There are actually fairies darting around, and when you see them, you can't tell if they are working or playing. It's all the same thing to them. My grandmother Buggy talks to fairies frequently. She calls me on the phone and tells me about her conversations with them. Fairies aren't strange to me at all. They're sort of like midget guardian angels with a good sense of humor. I am determined to take myself to that same magic place by learning my recital piece perfectly. I practice for hours and hours alone in the tiny practice room in the music building. That room is like a monk's cell, and I enjoy it. Just me, the piano, and one window where the afternoon light comes in and tries to make me sleepy. Sometimes I am tempted just to lie on the floor and take a nap, but Sister Philomena says, "God will not allow us to be overwhelmed by temptation, but with it he will provide a way of escape so that we will be able to endure it." I play those notes over and over until it feels like I can climb up inside them and live there. Piano practice is the best way I know to feel organized. It's just impossible to practice at home because Little Shep and Lulu do nothing but make fun of me. They run around the piano like wild Indians, screeching out their imitations of opera singers like hyenas. It is kind of a family hobby to make fun of opera singers. Mama taught Lulu to sing in pidgin Italian. "Ah, Spitonia, ah, pick of your boogers," and other nasty high-pitched phrases, and that is now Lulu's specialty for our family skits. Playing the piano is right up there with opera singing for Little Shep and Lulu in terms of being something to make fun of. The other problem with trying to practice at home is that you never know when the place is going to be filled with the yah-yahs. They roar up in their station wagons and Cadillacs to drink and play bourré. After they play and scream and cheat and drink and smoke, they always start singing songs about men. They moan out how fish have to swim and birds have to fly, and so they have to love one man till they die. You just cannot concentrate with all their moaning going on. But when I complain to Mama, she says, "Don't get dramatic with me, little Miss Sarah Bernhardt." So I make a bargain with baby Jesus. If I play The Elf and the Fairy perfectly at my recital, he will forgive me for pinching Lulu in church just to make her cry. If I play the composition flawlessly, baby Jesus might also forgive me for some other things that I can't quite name, but always feel guilty for anyway. I work harder and harder on the piece, picturing those notes while I try to fall asleep at night. My fingers strike the mattress until it feels like the bed is vibrating. I get all my memory work, fingering, timing, and phrasing down. All I have left to do are the final polishing touches. But the week before the recital, Mama goes to a big yah-yah party out at Little Spring Creek and cuts her foot up something awful on a broken Coke bottle. The other yah-yahs take her to the nearest emergency room and get the wound sewn up. But the cut is so deep, she has to use crutches to get around. We have never seen Mama cripple like this before, and it is kind of scary. The night after Mama's injury, Lulu and I are already in bed. I've sharpened my pencils and laid out my clothes for school the next day. They sit next to my book sack where my books, papers, and art supplies are arranged all neat. I can never fall asleep until everything is organized and ready to go at the foot of my bed. When I first hear the screaming from my parents' room, I think it's hurt dogs or something. I bolt up and dash down the hall. I can feel my bare feet squeak on the shiny wood floors. When I get to the entrance of Mama's long, narrow dressing room, Lulu, Little Shep, and Baylor are already there. How did they get there so fast before me? Daddy is standing next to the chaise lounge in his socks and boxer shorts. He has a toothbrush in his hand. Mama has on her pink nightgown with the lace, and the way its gathers fall, you can't hardly tell she's using crutches. I can smell the night cream on her face. In one hand, she has one of the squatty crystal glasses she drinks out of at night, the ones with heavy bottoms that don't tip over. They are already in the middle of it. Mama says, "You redneck bastard, don't you dare make those kinds of insinuations to me." Daddy says, "Insinuations, hell. I said you're a goddamn drunk, and I'll say it again. Why do you think you almost cut your fool foot off?" Even though he hasn't touched her, Mama looks like Daddy has split her up for kindling. Her expression changes, and she goes for him, slapping him hard in the face. They stand there yelling like the four of us are invisible. One closet door is open, and I can see Mama's ice-blue crepe sheath hanging with a laundry bag over it. Daddy lets Mama slap him. Then he knocks the glass out of her other hand. The glass falls to the floor and breaks, ice going everywhere, and you can smell bourbon in the dressing room along with Mama's rose sachets that hang in the closet. Mama braces one of her arms against the wall and raises the fist of her other hand and punches Daddy in the stomach. "As if you can talk, you pathetic excuse for a man," she yells. "You cowardly, dirt-farming loser." This is not happening, I think. I am not in this room. Then she goes to hit him again, but he pushes her away. Not hard, but like she's a duck trying to bite him. It throws her off balance, and she falls down. Those crutches just fly out from under her. This is the first time in our lives we've ever heard one of them call the other a drunk. It is like dynamite. It's bigger than even seeing her hit him or the way he pushed her. Just his saying that word drunk changes everything, even changes the air in the room. I don't cry because I can't breathe. Lulu starts eating her hair like she does whenever she gets upset. Little Shep and Baylor are mute, and Baylor is shaking. He looks so much like a little bird to me. Daddy looks down at Mama on the floor, and then he looks at us. But we won't look at him. He says to Mama, "You are not fit to raise these children." Then he turns and walks out of the room. I help Mama up on her crutches. She is shaking and crying. And she says, "We are getting out of this hellhole. Y'all go get your school clothes." When we stand there frozen, she yells, "Don't just stand there like ignoramuses. Y'all heard me. Go get your damn school things." I race to my room where I have my brown and gold dress with the drifting leaves laid on the chair. I scoop it up along with my slip, panties, socks, and cordovan tassel loafers. These loafers are my all-time favorite shoes, hand-me-downs from my teenage cousin and broken in just right. When I wear them, I feel like a cheerleader who writes poetry, like I have a guaranteed good future. Lulu says, "Sita, can I bring my turtle?" I say, "Shut up, Lulu." Then I grab my book sack, take my little sister by the hand, and fly down the hall to the kitchen door. As I run, I can see the couch, the TV set, and the piano from the corner of my eye. All our familiar things look foreign to me, and for just a second, I can't remember where I am or what I have done in my life before right now. Mama is already in the car with nothing but her nightgown, crutches, and purse. She's smoking and leaning on the horn, cussing at Daddy, who is nowhere in sight. I'm so frenzied, I drop my book sack and all my papers fly everywhere. Crayons roll under the car. One of my loafers falls on the concrete, and I reach down to get it, but Mama yells, "Sitta, get in the goddamn car!" Then she backs the car out of the long driveway and speeds down the gravel road, away from the house. We are all keyed up. We are quivering with fear and excitement at leaving the house so late on a school night. We quiz her, "Where are we going, Mama? Where are we going?" "We're going to Buggy's," she explains, and I breathe with relief to hear she has some kind of plan. Maybe this isn't so bad after all, I think. Maybe she's got this all mapped out. Maybe I'm being delivered into the life I was meant for. I love spending the night at my grandmother's old house near City Park. You get to stay up late there and walk to school. It's like a little vacation, if you don't mind her dog and kneeling to pray all the time. But halfway down the road, lined with old pecan trees that leads away from our house, Mama slams on the brakes and turns the car around. "I'm not losing every single thing I deserve because that bastard claims I run out on him," she yells. "We're going back. That son of a bitch is not going to get rid of me this goddamn easy." She squeals the car back under the carport. I walk toward the end of the driveway to catch my breath, but Mama yells at me, and I walk back into the house that is all quiet except for the sound of the air conditioner that Mama leaves running till Halloween. I don't let myself look at the furniture like I did on the way out. I go in the bathroom and run cold water on a wash rag and put it on my forehead like you're supposed to do when you're upset. Then I sit in my bed with my flashlight and try to straighten out my school things, which have gotten all messed up in the big getaway. I don't sleep that night, and I keep having a hard time getting my breath. I wish I had a fan blowing straight on me so I could get some air into my body. The next day at school, my head hurts and the back of my eyes burn. It's Friday, the day for my last piano lesson before my recital. Sister Philomena asked me to rehearse every move, the way I'm supposed to lift my hands to the keyboard before beginning the performance, the exact way I should gracefully rest them in my lap after the piece is over, my perfectly rehearsed curtsy. I try to picture smiling faces applauding for me, but all I can think of is how jumbled up all my school papers are, and how there are some important things missing from the night before that I can't seem to find. When I play for Sister Philomena, I don't miss any notes, but my timing is way off. She says, "Sitta Lee, be sure to give yourself some quiet practice time this weekend, and on Sunday, go to Holy Communion. Offer the recital up to the baby Jesus, and everything will be fine. He will give his angels charge concerning you to guard you in all your ways." But there's no chance to practice on Saturday. The day is devoted to converting our schoolroom into Mama's new bedroom. Daddy is nowhere in sight. Mama and Chaney rip down the blackboards from the walls. They haul out our desks, our toy boxes, and the tall shelves with the set of world books. In their place, Mama moves in a Hollywood bed she gets delivered from Holden's Fine Furniture, along with a matching nightstand and a new portable TV set. Before, no one was even allowed to smoke in that room because it was just for children. It was all ours. But now, it is Mama's new bedroom, and she has her silver and crystal ashtray with Yaya's 1960 engraved on the side, right there on her new night table. On the day of the recital, I'm real tired, but still sure of myself. I really know the elf and the fairy. Those notes won't abandon me in my powder blue dressy dress and patent leather shoes, with my hair rolled into a French twist, Mama's favorite style. I fast my 3 hours before communion, but at Mass, the sacred host sticks to the roof of my mouth and makes me nauseated. I feel like spitting up on the floor, but a mortal sin like that could easily take away my power of speech and make me grow a hare lip to boot. That Sunday afternoon, the Divine Compassion Auditorium is filled with mothers and fathers and aunts and grandmothers and the smell of floral arrangements and floor varnish. Mama hugs me tightly and whispers, "I adore you." I join the music students in the front row. I perch on my folding chair with my feet crossed at the ankles and off to one side like we're supposed to do. I watch the other students, one by one, rise from their seats, climb the steps to the high stage, and plunk out their recital pieces. Each one of them looks so afraid. I almost pity them. They're so insecure, so ill-composed. I feel utterly calm. I do not even feel like a child. When it's my turn, I sit down at the piano. My hands are steady. My hair is clean. My heart is true. But the moment I hit the first note, somebody else's hands, wild, shaking, and ignorant, take over. At first, I'm only kind of curious and dizzy. It takes me 8 entire measures to realize that I am the one producing the crazy, frantic noise. I am confused because part of me can actually hear myself playing the music impeccably. But the other part of me knows that the only thing left of the elf and the fairy is the phrasing. The rest is ugly, unrelated notes that crash through the thick air in that gymnasium. Inside myself, I can hear all the beauty, but my body can't respond. And I don't even consider just giving up. I keep on playing because I have to, and because I truly believe that I will finally discover the right notes and lead the audience into my elf and fairy world, where peaceful, out-of-state light glimmers and cleanses and redeems. I cannot stop myself. I attack the keyboard for the exact length of time it would have taken me to perform the piece like it's written. But not once do I manage to hit a note that sounds anything like the music I have spent months rehearsing. When I finish, I am sweating all over. I stand up from the piano in a trance and curtsy like I've practiced 100 times in front of the mirror. I look out into the audience. Even the other children are silent and wide-eyed. All the mothers are wiping tears from their eyes. I hate them all. Afterward, they walk by me and stare at me. Later that afternoon, some of the mothers call Mama to see how I am taking it. The next day at school, nobody makes fun of me. In fact, they are nicer than usual, which feels worse. I don't want anything to do with them. That afternoon, instead of going to my music lesson, I sneak out behind the parish hall where nobody can see me. I take one of Mama's cigarette lighters out of my uniform pocket, and I light the sheet music of The Elf and the Fairy on fire. I just flip open that little lighter and hold the flame under the notes. I think about setting all the grass back there on fire as well, but that would cause more trouble than I feel up to. I just burn up all those elf and fairy chords and stomp on the runaway sparks. Just as I'm finishing up, I hear somebody over by the walkway calling out my name. It's Sister Philomena. She sounds like she is scared that I'm lost. I remember how clean and neat her music room is, how when she plays the piano, it makes me feel like everything is in the right place for at least a while. I think about running to her and burying my head in her rustling black habit. For some reason, I think that if I do that, she will reach down and touch my face with her long, cool fingers that know how to move across a keyboard with total control. I don't run to her, though. I hide behind the concrete steps until she stops calling out my name and finally goes away. All I think then is, "Don't you dare call out my name ever again. You don't even know who I am." The Princess of Gimme. Lulu, 1967. I am, bar none, your best shoplifter in the town of Thornton, Louisiana. I would go so far as to say in all of Garnet Parish, maybe even in the entire great state of Louisiana. But to be perfectly truthful, I haven't spent enough time in New Orleans, our biggest city, to say that is definitely true. But I bet if you gave me one good weekend down there on Canal Street, I could ace out anybody in that city when it comes to five-finger discounts. I'm not bragging. I'm telling it like it is. I have learned to reach out and take what I want for my own self. I don't have to listen to Mama anymore saying, gimme, 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 every time I ask her for something. Gimme, 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 she says. That's all you are, Tallulah Abbott Walker, is gimme. Mama named me for Tallulah Bankhead. My daddy told her, no, you will not name a daughter of mine for a woman who claims she is pure as the driven slush. But Mama told him she was the one who had thrown up and cared me for 9 solid months, and she would name me after whoever she damn well pleased. I will tell you this.